Well, hey, record collectors, it's Nate from The Vinyl Guide, and I am here to tell you about the Groove Washer. The Groove Washer is the best record cleaner you can get on the market today. I've seen lots of generic fluids that are advertised to clean records, but God only knows what's in them. Groove Washer's G2 fluid is purposefully made for cleaning records thoroughly and allowing them to dry easily and stored indefinitely. Those generic cleaners, who knows what they'll do to your records in the long run. Get the name you can trust for your vinyl at groovewasher.com. And you could start simple. A Groove Washer kit starts at only $15. And of course, there's some deluxe bundles at groovewasher.com that will sort you out for years to come. Plus, here's a 10% off discount code. Enter vinylguide10 at checkout and get 10% off everything at groovewasher.com. That's vinylguide10 at groovewasher.com. Groovewasher.com, proud to be made in the USA. And with that, let's start this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide.
Hello, this is Amon Tobin. You're listening to The Vinyl Guide.
Do you listen to and collect vinyl records? Well, you're in luck. Welcome to The Vinyl Guide, the podcast made for record nerds like yourself. Here's your host, the biggest record nerd of them all, Nate Goyer.
Hey everyone, it's Nate. I hope you're doing well in this ever-changing world of ours. You know, the past few weeks have shown some amazing treachery and some amazing courage. So, well done to all the peaceful protesters and people who are really making their feelings on the murder of George Floyd heard. This is the way change will come. So, well done, everyone. Keep it up. All right, so I'm going to stick to what I know, talking about records and record shops, and I'm very happy to say, this week in Sydney, I actually got to go to a couple of record shops as well as a record fair. Actually, it wasn't exactly a record fair. It was a small market with the guy who had about half a dozen or more crates of records. So there was a record stall. I got to flip through those crates, and I found a few nice ones to take home. So it felt really good. I was so glad to be getting back into that. Can't wait for more. I also got to enjoy a few record shops. I hit up Vintage Record in Sydney and Annandale, picked up some marvelous records there, including a first pressing of The Saints' I'm Stranded. It's an Australian pressing. I love that album. And Phil had it right on the wall, and I said, that'll be mine now. So yeah, it was good seeing Phil. Also got a copy of Captain Beyond's debut album. Got some AC/DC on Albert Productions. Again, Vintage Record in Sydney. Thank you so much, Phil. I also got to stop by Egg Records in Newtown. And again, it was so great being in a record shop. And it's a really nice sign that we're doing well down under, just coming out of the COVID lockdowns, and we're now being rewarded with a bit of normality. So still a ways to go, but I like the way we're heading. Now, this week on The Vinyl Guide, I'm very excited to be sharing with you a wonderful conversation with an amazing musician and producer, Amon Tobin. Now, most of you will be familiar with Amon Tobin's work, Adventures in Foam, his releases on the Ninja Tune label, including the groundbreaking iSam album, his history with record collecting and sampling, his absolutely unbelievably innovative leaps in music production and sampling and live shows. I mean, just Google Amon Tobin iSam Live and check out his stunning projection mapping live show. Nearly 10 years later, it is still jaw-droppingly killer. Now, you may know that Amon has been pretty quiet over the last 7 or 8 years, only a few minimal releases here and there, but he was busy focusing on reinventing himself and his approach to music production. And that alone is fascinating. Amon talks about this time today, as well as his new label, No Mark Records, which you can check out at nomarkrecords.bandcamp.com. It's a very interesting approach he's taking, a new model for an artist. Effectively, Amon is allowing listeners to have a subscription service where all materials he releases during this period can be accessed in high-definition files. Now again, I'll put up some links, or you can go to nomarkrecords.bandcamp.com, check it out for yourself, and hopefully sign up. It's quite an interesting approach, and I reckon this is a great way for other artists to reach their fan base in the future. And the vinyl. How could I forget the vinyl? Of course, Amon and I talk about vinyl, his early days with records, his adventures in crate digging, his navigation of record shops around the world, the competition with other DJs of finding the obscure records to mine for samples, and much, much more. We go deep on today's show and also talk about the current vinyl offerings. Right now, Amon Tobin's latest EP with Two Fingers has a vinyl offering that goes away at the end of this week. So head over to twofingersbeats.bandcamp.com. I'll put the link in the episode page. Order a copy of this vinyl before you can't get it any longer. This EP is great. You can listen to it at twofingersbeats.bandcamp.com. Try before you buy, but then get one before they're gone. That's twofingersbeats.bandcamp.com. And finally, I need to let you know there are hundreds of electronic, disco, funk, soul, and other DJ records available at AudiophileUSA.com, and they are all in excellent and near mint shape. AudiophileUSA.com sells only excellent and near mint vinyl records, so head over there now and check out their selection. Over 42,000 titles in stock and more being added each week. AudiophileUSA.com is a family-owned and operated business, and they ship worldwide. So do yourself and your record collection a favor. Head over to AudiophileUSA.com and find your holy grail. And with that, let's start today's episode featuring our conversation with DJ Amon Tobin. So today on The Vinyl Guide, we have with us musician, producer, record, and fellow synth nerd, DJ Amon Tobin. How are you today? How are things where you're at today, Amon?
Everything's on fire, as it should be, I guess. And it's pretty messy out here, but otherwise, tickety-boo.
Now, you're in Los Angeles, yeah? East L.A.?
Yeah, I am. I'm in Highland Park.
Ooh. Some of my favorite record shops are in Highland Park. Permanent, Gimme Gimme, and a few others.
All right. Yeah, it's too bad. I think a few of them have gone out of business recently, too. Before, you know, this whole pandemic thing started, I think it was, rents are getting pretty expensive, I think. And it's, I don't know how it is, where you are, but, you know, record shops obviously, aren't as ubiquitous as they used to be, so people I think are struggling to, you know, to keep them going.
Oh my goodness. All right, well, I'd hate to see that happen. Those are some great shops, and that's such a great neighborhood as well, so I hope everyone emerges from this okay. We'll set the riots and we'll set COVID-19 aside for a moment. They're both very important things we have to deal with, but I want to talk to you about music today. A little oasis in the madness, if that's okay.
Yeah, man, of course.
Now, you've had a very, very busy first part of the year. Ghost Cards, a new Two Fingers release, the No Mark Record Club. It seems like you've had more projects in the last 8 months than in the previous 8 years. Why now? What has been happening to build up to this point?
It's a bit like a duck with his legs under the water this last 8 years for me, because it's not like anything stopped. I just kept recording, but I did stop was releasing stuff. I just kind of needed to get into a sort of an incubation period or something and develop a series of different projects. So that took a lot of time, and I wanted to develop them properly before I just kind of sprang them out into the world, you know. So I really took my time and recorded a bunch of stuff over this period, which finally I get to put out, and I'm so happy to be doing that now.
And you're not wasting any time. It's there's a lot coming out, which is fantastic. But during those 8 years, to be able to have, I'll call it a luxury, even though I'm sure there was some maddening moments in there, to be able to have the time and the luxury to be able to evolve to that next level, was there a lot of self-doubt in that time?
I don't know about self-doubt. I mean, there's always self-doubt, right? I think you'd be some sort of sociopath if you didn't have some element of self-doubt. But no more or less than at any other point, right? You kind of have a measured insecurity, I think, in your work, and you work past it, sort of fooling yourself sometimes into thinking something's better than it is, and other times underplaying stuff which maybe has more potential than you realize. And all the time you just kind of keep your head down. And to be honest, I wouldn't say I'm immune to that, but I'm less affected by that because, I kind of get carried away with the process. And for me, what I think what's the most interesting thing is trying to learn stuff along the way, right? And that's kind of my focus. So all of the music that comes out is almost like a byproduct of my own curiosity for sound and music. And the releases are a byproduct of that. So it's a few stages down even. So I don't feel particularly frozen by the notion of, you know, what people might make of what I do. That comes now, you know, now I'm feeling all of that anxiety because I have to share it with people.
did you kind of know where you were sailing? Did you have a bit of a North Star that you wanted to get to and it just took time, or was there a lot more exploration, some fogginess that you had to work through?
No, I was pretty mapped out. Because it's been a long time I've been developing these things, right? So like Two Fingers, this is the third album. So it's in a kind of an established, lane of my own stuff. Something like Child Tyrant, really I can trace back to tracks like, Get Your Snack On and, Four Ton Mantis, things that I kind of, looked at on a, I guess a more sort of a fleeting, in a more fleeting way many, many years ago. So, you know, all of these things have had sort of the germs of being, an idea a long time ago. And I've just quietly been, either suppressing them or trying to shoehorn them into something else. And when it kind of dawned on me over time that I didn't really need to do that, I could just separate them into parallel lanes. And by doing that, I could really let each one kind of flourish, without abandoning any particular, musical interest. I can kind of follow them all in parallel.
And when you're in the creative space, how do you determine what is an Amon track, what is a Two Fingers or a Child Tyrant track?
You know, if it was really up to me, I think I'd probably just call them all one thing. Because I'm not all that bothered about, you know, whether this fits into that or that fits into this. But I think at least to be a little bit considerate, you know, to people who might be listening or seeking any of this music out, I think it's helpful to put them into at least, you know, categories of music that have some relationship to each other. So, I mean, it seems very clear to me, right? If I make a Child Tyrant track, it's going to sound like some kind of, I don't know, demented kraut surf thing with very sort of live sounding drums and it's going to be quite energetic and, riff based music. And if it's going to be Two Fingers, then it's going to be stuff that I've made really for clubs, bass music. And my own stuff is a broader range of things. Of course, it's like a kind of ongoing, I don't know, art experiment, something really quite personal, you know, and so that I don't think it's that tricky to put them into these groups particularly.
But all these groups and more start to fold in and contribute to the No Mark Record Club. It's a subscription service through Bandcamp, yeah?
Well, yeah, I mean, primarily my hope would be that they each thing sort of informs the other, right? So my goal is to sort of enrich my own musical world, and so if I can learn something from doing a Two Fingers track that I can apply to a track under my own name, I'll do that, and vice versa. So it's really a creative thing, but the subscription thing is more like a I don't know, like a life raft for this label, honestly, because it's obviously just a stupid idea to have a record label right now, and it really has kind of helped it survive this whole last year by having that in place. You know, people can basically support it. And I'm trying to make it a really kind of a proper thing. You know, it's not like, oh, here, pay some money and then you'll get like some offcuts and B-sides and shit I might throw away. It's like, I really want to make consistent, contributions to that, like every month or every couple of months I'll put something like a full EP or some fully formed things on that in return, you know, as well as obviously having all the rest of the releases on the label. So I feel in general the response has been that it's been a pretty great experience for people.
It's pretty innovative. I mean, you know, you say starting a record label may be a crazy idea, but it's not really a label. It's more like a software as a subscription service, and people can sign up, and I'll put the links in the episode page, but I think it's very unique. I'd like to see where this goes, because I would imagine that other artists, particularly ones who are prolific, can use this sort of model as an offshoot to, you know, continue doing what they do and reaching the fans who are really fans of them and their work and are willing to go wherever the artist is going to take them.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I don't obviously, like, subscription things aren't in any way unique to what I'm doing. But what is interesting, I think, is you pointed out, is it's not really a label. It's more like a vehicle for all these different musical interests that I have to kind of bloom and develop. So in that sense, it is kind of it's unfamiliar ground. And it's just by nature of the fact that I've got so much material that I've done, you know, over this last decade almost. So it is quite an unusual position. It's not like I could say that's a functioning model for anyone, like go and record for 10 years in the woods and then, you know, set up a kind of label. It's not practical by any means. And God knows, who knows if it's sustainable, but I'm trying, you know, to make it work. And so far, so good. Yeah.
Now, your songwriting seems to have evolved quite a bit. Originally, a lot of sampling. Now you seem to be focusing a great deal on synthesis. I mean, albums like Foley Room are extremely forthcoming regarding even down to the title of the album, right? But right. It seems these days less music concrete, less field recordings or found sound, as far as I can tell anyway. Am I interpreting that correct?
Yeah, for sure. I guess ultimately, yeah, for sure. I guess really the common thread is sort of limitations, right? So I always looked at samples as these really interesting limitations in which you can work. And I do believe that creativity is kind of born of limitations. It's sort of a bastard child of limited resources. It's kind of like whatever you can do within a small set of parameters to sort of climb out and beyond those parameters is your creativity, right? And that's all you can really take credit for as an artist, I think. So having those occupy different spaces doesn't really matter as much as having confines that you can try and escape from. And so for some time they were things from records. And I kind of took that about as far as I could creatively. I think the idea is also over time, in the 90s, the idea of taking a sound that had its own life and it's in a completely different world and sort of removing it from that world, like a snapshot of that world, and putting it in a different context was really interesting, and mixing things together that didn't necessarily fit together, like different genres of music in a very sort of literal way with sampling, was really interesting. And I think at the time it was innovative and fascinating, but nothing can stay stagnant. And I think there was kind of a very organic process beyond that. That happened, at least with me, where I guess samples got smaller and smaller down to a sort of a grain, really. And at that point, the point of it being a recording from a different world, removed from that world, doesn't really make sense, because the sort of any recognition of the origin of that sound is long gone. And as soon as you've lost that, then there's no point in it having an origin, right? Do you see what I mean? Like, it's like if you...
You took what was... When I used to hear the sampling in the 90s, I thought it was clever, someone putting Pink Floyd over a breakbeat. There was that combination that people didn't expect. And then as you start to kind of break things down to the elemental levels, that uniqueness or that aha starts to disappear.
Well, that's exactly what I mean, right? Like, if you recognize the origin of these things that have been torn from their, natural habitat, then it's really interesting, right? When they've been sort of unnaturally married together. But if that source, is no longer there, then what's the point? It's just sound at that point. And so it kind of got more and more about tiny, tiny sounds, and then sounds that were field recorded and then processed, and then sounds that were field recorded and then synthesized, right through to pure synthesis. And so it's just been a kind of a very gradual evolution for me.
Yeah, if you're breaking samples down to the micron, you might as well start with a waveform.
Well, it's a granular synthesis at that point, and yeah, exactly.
Do you still collect sounds in the wild? Do you still do any found sound or field recordings?
Yeah, I went through a bunch of different stages, right, with all of that. I have to say, though, like, there was a real romance to hunting records for sounds, specifically records, because again, it couldn't be done the same way now, because we just live in a different time. But, at that time, when record stores, you could find them, these places in like forgotten cities at the edge of nowhere that you might tour on. And I mean, I would organize tours so that they routed through towns that might have particular record stores, right? Like, and it would be very sort of strategic, and there was a race with the other people you were touring with at sound check or whatever. You might try and wrap up your sound checks really fast so that you could get to the record store before your opener did or somebody else, right? And so we'd always, there was all this kind of anxiety and sort of competitive side of it that was a lot of fun, actually, at the time. I remember touring with, like, I think it was Vadim and who was the other guy? Somebody else from Ninja, and I think they were in British Columbia, and they were trying to get to a store over in one of the islands across the way, and one of them, I think, ended up taking a helicopter to get there before the other guy. It was that kind of thing. It was kind of rabid, but yeah, I mean, that's it. Though now, I mean, you try and do that now, and of course all the stores, well, most of them wouldn't be there. The ones that would be there would be very, very carefully curated. And for me, my process of record buying was really, I wanted it to be a mystery. I wanted to go into the store with a little portable record player and only pick out stuff that I didn't know, so I could be surprised, you know, and really kind of get guided by, let's say, the artwork or just, I don't know, the sort of sense of it, you know, the aesthetic of the record and try and see if that could guide me somewhere.
So let's unpack that a little bit because, all right, you go into a record shop, there's probably 5,000-10,000 records in the shop, yeah. And you're going to select 5 or 6 to leave with. Okay. A small pile. I'm sure you left with larger piles than that, but how do you find those 5 records? How do you determine that those are the ones you're going to take home and the other 9,000 whatever is staying there?
It wasn't a difficult thing that because it was just on the clock because, I mean, all of my record buying was done really on tour. It was always in sound checks. It was always a limited amount of time. If we could get an extra day in a city before flying somewhere else, that would be the time to go to, you know, whatever the locals were saying was the spot. And then we'd go there or some hidden place or some room behind another room behind a, you know, a store or, and so it was this kind of, you know, treasure hunt. And you always had a small amount of time in those places before you had to go do the next thing. So you would really just set up. And, that's why I ended up with my portable system because I couldn't waste time queuing up to use the store's record player, you know, the sort of whatever they might have 2 or 3 if you were lucky or, you know, usually just 1 in a small store, sometimes none. And, if you were there with a group of people who are all like frantically hunting for stuff, you're never going to get anything when they're sat there, you know, skipping through a pile of 50 records, you know, but so I'd go in with my own, my headphones. I'd install myself in the corner of the store. I'd always ask the record store owner if it was okay for me to do that. I had a good, you know, little cartridge.
Good manners.
Good manners is really important because, you know, they were a strange breed, the record store owners, at least in those days. And yeah, I don't know. I have a good needle on the thing and I just scan through and try and listen to as much as I could in the time I had and walk out with what I had time to grab.
So you obviously wouldn't go to the new releases. I imagine you would probably go toward the $5 bins or the racks that seemed to be the most ignored. Like, what was your strategy going into a shop?
Well, you have to sort of take into account that I wasn't a record collector ever. Right. I was never like, oh, I must have the, you know, the mono Japanese release of this particular thing or the, you know, or the sealed copy of that or this B side of my whole interest was in finding unusual sounds that I could rebuild into other things. So I would go to the records that looked like they might deliver that to me, and I'd find myself in, you know, avant-garde electroacoustic sections or strange percussion records from, you know, world music sections, or often a lot of jazz stuff, soundtrack stuff, things that the more obscure the better. In fact, if anybody did know what a record was, it was kind of, you were slightly defeated because you knew that it had probably been plundered already or, you know. But I mean, there were lots of different styles to that. There were lots of people that were after that break and they were collectors. They wanted that break or they wanted that, you know, Bob James sample or that, you know, whatever, you know. But that wasn't me. I was looking for other things.
What's the record that you found that you could remember that gave you the most, I guess, content or inspiration? The one that you, I'll just say discovered, but the one that you got that you mined the most?
You know, I had a real lucky moment once when my dad's an English teacher and he was working in his building. I think they were moving into an old BBC radio building, and like their school was anyway. And so the BBC radio was clearing out, and he just called me one day, and he's like, it was one night, and he goes, yeah, so they've left a bunch of records. I don't know if you're interested up there. You know, come and you want to come and check them out. And of course, I went down, and it was like, I don't know, like a few thousand like mint condition Bollywood records, like incredible, an incredible collection of stuff that from many different decades, you know, still in their sort of HMV from India boxes, and it was incredible. And in amongst those, I found a copy of R.D. Burman Shalimar. I hope I'm saying that right.
The soundtrack from Shalimar?
Yeah, yeah. Which I really treasure to this day. It's beautiful gatefold, and it's just, you know, it's got some of my favorite music on it too. And so, yeah, that was probably one of my favorite finds.
That's amazing, because I found that record in a, I won't even call it a record shop, a record stall in Delhi. Not New Delhi, but Delhi.
Oh, wow.
In this 100-year-old bazaar. And I found this little tent that was selling records, and my son and I went in there, and they served us tea. And as you do in India, you know, it's not like a regular record store. You sit down, they serve you tea, they put on different records, and Shalimar was one of the maybe dozen I took home from that.
Amazing. Isn't it a great record?
Yeah, it's got a gun on the front, right?
That's right. And, yeah. With the black and white.
What else is interesting is on the show, I was speaking with Trey Spruance of Mr. Bungle.
Oh, yeah.
He also had a Shalimar story.
Oh, yeah. Amazing. Okay. That's really cool.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. All right. This is, 6 degrees here. So do you still go to vinyl shops? Is vinyl still an interest to you?
No, honestly. I mean, vinyl is an interest to me because I have this incredible, it's not even a giant collection or anything, but it's a very interesting collection of records, which were really, I guess, like part of my own lens that, you know, through which I kind of learned about music and they just mean everything, you know. They're like having a little time capsule of things that had a direct impact on what I did. And so, yeah, I mean, like I said, I was never a record collector. I was always a sound collector. And that's what they are. I mean, to be honest, there were other periods of time where it was more to do with new music. Like when I started DJing, it was all vinyl, right? Still. Cause I'm old as fuck, right? So it's like, it was, I remember having, I still have a great drum and bass collection on vinyl. I have a decent hip hop collection on vinyl. But other than that, you know, it's really peculiar records, odds and ends, a few things that probably are collectible. I don't even know, you know, but I'm not, you know, digging now.
What do you see in terms of the future of music consumption? You seem to have gone from vinyl, which, you know, an analog world, to clearly digital with No Mark Record Club and lossless file downloads. And I would imagine, you know, the future of music tends to be more on the digital side. But do you think that there is a future or continuation of the history of vinyl going forward?
Well, yeah, I mean, of course, and it's not entirely accurate, you know, to say that. I release all my stuff on vinyl still, and make a point of it. I think for me, it's obviously the most delicious and tangible format for music. And it's not just about, oh, look at this nice cover and, oh, you can roll a joint on it or any of that stuff. It's the fact that when you have an album on vinyl, you kind of, you know, unless you're one of these crazy people who can jump up every 2 seconds and skip to the next thing, you know, you sort of listen to an album in a different way where things can sort of marinate. And often tracks which you might have overlooked on first listen will take on a new light after a certain amount of time. And it's often happened where tracks have become my favorites on an album, you know, after just being forced to listen to them because they were on the, I couldn't be bothered to get up, you know, and change the. So I think it's a really, it's a format that lends itself to the kind of music I particularly make, because my music often isn't immediate. It's not about like an instant consumption thing. In fact, I don't even like to think of music being consumed. I think it should be experienced and lived with, and you develop a relationship with things you love. And as a music lover, I think it's important to love the, you know, the experience and the format it's on. It sort of plays a big part in that, I'd say.
When going about making records of your music, how involved are you in the decisions around manufacturing? So, for example, if some of your music is coming out on vinyl, are you across either the colors of the vinyl or the materials or the pressing plant that makes it?
Yeah, well, to be honest, I'm more involved than I'd like to be, because I have to be. You know, we're not a big label. It's me and like four other wonderful people at the moment.
That's a big label these days, by the way.
I guess, I don't know. But yeah, I mean, I micromanage every conceivable aspect of everything, much to people's frustration. And I mean, I always have done anyway with artwork and live shows and anything like that. That's not necessarily true. I remember the first few records I did on Ninja, I really just let, Kev, his DJ Food, just design whatever he wanted. And I was more than happy. He's such a great designer and I wasn't really overly concerned. But over the years, I've become quite involved in the design. I was particularly proud. I did an EP, I'm struggling to remember the name of my own records. Jesus. It was like the sci-fi sounding EP.
Not Dark Jovian.
Yeah, thank you. Jesus Christ. Oh. Yeah. And and I had this idea, you know, it's like, oh, okay. And I talked a lot with the designers about the feasibility of it, of making a record that didn't really have a cover. It was like the outside of it was its own cover, and it was, you know, the two pieces of vinyl were facing each other, kind of protecting each other with a little rubber separation in the center, but mm-hmm. it would all be held together by kind of like an external tire almost that would wrap around it. And it came out great. You know, I was really happy with that.
Yeah. So it's like a paint lid.
Yeah, yeah, I know. I mean, it's not a practical piece of...
Now, that album, Dark Jovian, was white vinyl.
Right.
I don't see a lot of DJ vinyl that is not black. Do you have a preference, or have you experienced a difference between the types of materials that are best for DJ vinyl?
I mean, honestly, I was always kind of surprised. I had this idea that the heaviest vinyl is always the best idea, you know. But I've got records which are so thin, you know, you can hold them on the corner and they'll just flop down, like some classical records, very dynamic. And they sound incredible. I don't know, man. I'm, you know, in terms of the color, I'm not really sure how that affects it, to be honest. I just really love the idea of a milky white record for that particular piece of music,
especially for an album called Dark Jovian.
Yeah, that
was an interesting juxtaposition.
Right.
So your vinyl in your house right now is it's on a shelf. Does it have its own room? Like, how would you describe your musical collection, the vinyl section?
It's all over my place. I mean, it's all over the place. So I have, and I mean, mostly it's on the floor. People would be horrified, actually. I
You're not a record collector. You put that up front.
I know, exactly. I do have shelves for some things, but the majority of things are kind of in groups. They're not carefully catalogued at all. There's a sort of a personal arrangement of different groups of music that I've placed in various areas of at least the living room. My Bollywood stuff is in my son's room, and actually I listen to vinyl mostly with my boy because, you know, it's just a nice thing in the morning to, when we're making breakfast, I'll put on some, you know, classic dad rock, or I'll freak him out with some, you know, bizarre electronic stuff, and it's just a nice way, I think, to introduce him to music, because we do end up listening to the same record all day long, often just keep flipping it round, and I like that. I like the idea of living with music for more than a minute.
Yeah, we do the same thing, only on the other side of the day. It's like kids always want to stay up late. So we say, okay, well, you could stay up an extra half hour, but you have to listen to the record with dad. And
right.
You can't be talking. You can't be on your phone. You just have to enjoy.
Yeah, that's it. Just for a fucking second, just, you know, I don't know, smell the roses or something.
Yeah, yeah. But that's not the time to put on the punk rock.
No, that's right. Exactly.
You've got your records. I'm not going to call it organized, but at least they're not in the bathtub yet.
No, they're not.
When it comes to organization, you've got a lot of audio, a lot of sounds, a lot of samples. Are you able to find those samples quickly? Like when you're in the creative mode, can you quickly obtain some sounds that maybe you recorded a few years ago that you think could work for this particular creation?
No. I mean, I haven't worked with samples since, you know, I don't know, the early 2000s.
Oh, you're doing zero samples. It's all synthesis.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, it has. I mean, I kind of got sidetracked a bit. Sorry, earlier when I was talking about vinyl hunting. But yeah, no, it's been like a different kind of process from a few different records. I think by the time I got to Foley Room, there wasn't really sampling going on. I was going out, you know, recording stuff and trying to learn about recording and microphones and how that world worked. It was something I'd never looked at. So it was new and exciting to me, you know. And then, when ISAM came, I was less interested even in where the sounds came from. Because, you know, on Foley Room, I went through great lengths, right? I flew around the country looking for strange locations. I went to, like, I visited zoos and recorded animals in their night habitats, and went to safaris and factories and did all that stuff, and musicians as well, recording with strange equipment. And I guess, yeah, by the time I got to ISAM, I wasn't really leaving the studio at all. I was taking the sounds around me and doing an awful lot with very little. It was really about trying to make a algorithmic, a process, you know, so taking a waveform and looking at its spectral content and synthesizing it in a way that it would be malleable and elastic. And yeah, and so, and with these recent records, I've kind of gone from the idea of, you know, trying to push things as far as I could in terms of DSP and processing and futuristic aspirations, to really quite simple things, to analog hardware and things as old as the Mellotron, and, you know, things that make simple wave shapes and using synthesis in that way. So yeah, it's been a long time since I've plundered records.
And your primary synthesizers at this moment, you have a Buchla system, as I understand. And for listeners who aren't synth nerds, it's a Buchla is like the Bugatti of synthesizers. only with Bugatti, you don't need to learn a whole different language to drive one. I would imagine with the Buchla, you could spend hours upon hours of just getting lost in the machine. Yeah.
I think you can do that with anything, but I know what you mean. I definitely do. I think there's a lot of people, particularly in the modular world. In fact, it's kind of, I mean, it's not that different from vinyl collecting. There are people who are primarily concerned with the object, you know, and let's say the authenticity of the object, its origin and its history. And there are people, like me who are mainly concerned with what it can do, you know, the function of the object. And I'm not saying that those things are mutually exclusive, but they do often fall into those different camps. And I think, a lot of the time what happens with synthesizers and synthesizer music is the sheer joy of using it, kind of eclipses the end result, because it is a gorgeous thing to lose yourself in. But I'm kind of obsessed with structure, and I like frameworks to work inside. So my approach is never to kind of noodle and jam and just sort of see what happens. It's more of a conversation with an unreliable collaborator, right? Because they really don't always do what they're told, these things. But you set a framework and you try and get as close to it as you can. And often what these instruments will do is they'll give you an approximation of that. And sometimes it will be more interesting than the idea you had. And other times it will just be frustrating.
Right. So how much of your time, you say noodling, how much of your time would be noodling and experimentation versus a deliberate production of a vision that you have in your head that you're eager to realize?
Yeah, I mean, like I say, I'm not that interested in noodling. I usually have a song or whatever you want to call it, a piece of music, pretty much worked out in my head, and then I'll try and get as close to it as I can, and I'll always fail, right? I'll never quite get there, but I'll get pretty close sometimes.
Okay, that's interesting. Do each of your songs, each of your works, do they have a meaning or a theme? I mean, I believe they'd have a mood, but is there a literal message or theme that you have in your head you're working with?
No, I don't. I kind of have a more emotional relationship with music, honestly. I also think music's enough, to be honest. I'm not sure I'm really on board with the idea that, you know, music always has to be part of some greater narrative, or where's the visual concept, and, you know, what's the message you're trying to get across. And I understand there's a lot of incredible music that's made on that basis, but I'm so interested in the sound and just how harmony works, or how, that honestly I don't get too involved in anything beyond that.
Okay, so for instance, like today, we're in the midst of these George Floyd protests, and there's rioting, and there's a lot of unrest and discomfort out there. Is that an emotion that you are now working with going into the studio? You fire up the Buchla. Now you've got that emotion of either confusion or maybe anger. Does that become a motivator within what you create today?
I don't know. I don't know how... I don't know how you'd measure how outside influences sort of contribute to what you do. You know, I'm a bit close to it, honestly. I do think that if I want to be thinking about that, I'll go out and march, and that's what I'll do. But if I'm making music, I'm not consciously trying to, you know, funnel my political or, you know, my general views and frustrations into that particularly. I mean, but I'm not saying they won't seep in, right? They probably do.
Yeah, either conscious or unconscious. Like, you know, looking at it in retrospect, like, oh, okay, this was a period where I was, you know, listening to a lot of jazz or
I was eating too much sugar or something. This is kind of what must have been a result of that.
Well, yeah, I think the best example of that is probably Figueroa, which is a thing I don't know when this is going to come out, but it might. We're going to release it sort of end of July, and it might line up. I don't know, but that whole project happened during a very specific time in my life, and it was there was a lot of just drinking in the woods going on, and lots of songs about love and death, you know, the endless those classic tropes, and so yeah, I think on some level there are projects and particular pieces of music that I can attribute to a specific time or mood. Yeah.
Yeah, because when I listen to Bricolage, I think, oh, okay, he got really deep into jazz at this point.
Sure. Well, you know what, though? It wasn't even it wasn't as much about jazz as it was about what would happen if you took jazz out of its understood area, right, its context, and what if you married that with some very unusual at the time sounds and rhythms. So it was more to do with the displacement of these things than the things themselves.
Now, I imagine motion picture soundtrack work presents an interesting constraint for you in that it's a shared vision and you need to align with that of the filmmaker. Is that comfortable for you to do?
I haven't had a lot of experience, honestly, with it. I think when the right project or film or people actually are there, it can be a very painless process because you're kind of you have similar tastes ultimately, right? You're kind of going for the same thing, and you understand what the other person wants because it's what you want as well. But then, you know, I'm really not very good at using music as a sort of to do my bidding, you know. It's not like I can be like, all right, we need you to sound like this, and I can go off and recreate something. I mean, I guess I could. I find that so dull. But I'm more interested in, you know, in talking with somebody about what are you trying to, what would you like to amplify here? You know, in what I can see visually, what area of this should we try and underscore, and try and do that with music. And it's really interesting the way different people have done that as well. I find it fascinating. Look at people like Bernard Herrmann and the way he used particular sounds, you know, to do that, to play these certain roles. And of course, now we have this, like, you can think of the shower scene in Psycho, and you'll always, you know, that sort of screeching sound will always sound the way it should. Like, that's how a stabbing knife sounds, but he had to imagine that, you know, and I love that. I love that idea of imagining what a sonic interpretation of a visual motion might be.
I was just listening to a soundtrack to A Clockwork Orange and just marveling how Wendy Carlos was able to use the soundtrack to make a perverse movie even more so.
Sure.
Just twist it so much. And that's something that I would imagine that would be of interest to most musicians to try that on. But you've tried that hat on. Do you find more freedom in that or doing video game soundtracks?
I've really only ever done one or maybe two video game soundtracks. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I'm just not really a jobbing musician, honestly. I'm far too I guess, interested in just making, you know, music for music's sake. But I have found those experiences very, very rewarding, though, because they do present you with a different set of challenges. I just don't think I could really do music for a job on the regular, you know.
Well, sometimes you have to try something to realize that it's not for you.
Well, I'm not saying that. You know, what I'm saying is that I think as a career, I wouldn't be a very good media composer. I think that's what people are called, right? Media composers, like, because it's just a different area of music. But if there was a film that I really gelled with, or if there was even a game that I thought, oh, I could really contribute to that, or I could really, I know what that has to sound like, then I'd dive in for sure.
And for No Mark Records, you've got the subscription service. And again, people can check that out at nomarkrecords.bandcamp.com. What other projects do you have coming out in 2020?
Well, I have Figueroa, as I mentioned, and that's going to be quite a polarizing record, I'd imagine, because my prediction is it'll probably be ignored by the wider musical public and maybe alienate my existing fans to an extent, but I wanted to make it, and I'm so proud of it. I'm terrified of releasing it too, so I'm really curious how that'll work out.
Well, yeah, don't go into it with that attitude.
No, but that's the thing. That's kind of going back to what I was saying. Like, when I make this stuff, nothing could be further from my mind. It's only when you come to the point where you have to suddenly share it with people that you start wondering, oh, I wonder what they'll make of it. And that's not a very comfortable place to be.
I'm sure they'll go with you on that journey.
Let's hope so.
Now, the subscription is started in September of 2019. Shall we assume that it just continues to roll that way?
That's the plan. We'll see, you know, how many people are on board. Around September, I think we will think about doing the next, because we do it in sections, right? So it's like a volume one, which ran from last September through to this September, and then we'll start again next, I guess October. But yeah, so there's that. The Stone Giants, which will be coming out hopefully later in the year as well. Another alias called Paperboy, which we'll start to introduce too.
So people joining No Mark Records .bandcamp.com right now, they get all the stuff that was released from September all the way through now, through this September.
Yeah, basically they get all the albums I released this year digitally, and then they get all the other stuff that I've made just for the club or along the way.
And I understand that you also were a bit of a beta tester for the new Bandcamp vinyl program, is that right?
Yeah, can I just say how much I fucking love Bandcamp, man? They're just such good people, and they really seem to have, I'm one of the few entities that really seem to be behind the artists. I mean, genuinely, you know, and I love their whole approach to how they operate. And one of these things that, yeah, I mean, honestly, the first few records we pressed on vinyl were kind of a disaster because, I mean, the amount of problems we had with manufacturer, you know, everything that could go wrong basically went wrong. Things weren't printed quite right, and then they weren't shipped the way they should have been. We kept changing and experimenting with different fulfillment companies, and it was really hard going. And so Bandcamp came along with the idea of doing this thing where it's really, it takes all of that pressure off of me, and I can just, I can go, look, here's the record. It's going to be on vinyl. However many people want it, you've got this much time to buy it. And if it hits a certain target, we'll definitely make it. And then we'll press as many as people order, you know. And it was amazing. Like in the first, I think 2 hours, we had like like 200% or something. We'd completely, you know, gone through our target, right, super quick. And I think we're like almost 400% now, and there's still 10 days to go. And so it's this amazing, amazing response to that. They've really come to the rescue on that front.
And you're talking about the Two Fingers Fight, Fight, Fight EP, which is great. I was blasting that the other night, and the family was like, what is that? That's good. All right. Well, we're getting it on vinyl. So we'll have it on the big stereo before you know it.
Thanks, man.
So people can check that out at twofingersbeats.bandcamp.com. I've spent a lot of money on Bandcamp this year, and I always feel great about it because not only am I getting some great music, but I'm also helping artists directly. And like you said, Bandcamp really seems to have its shit together, which is a fantastic foundation for a lot of creative works to make their way out into the world.
Yeah, very much.
So, Amon, thank you so much for joining us here on The Vinyl Guide. Again, I'm going to put some links in this episode page. Everyone, please consider joining the No Mark Records subscription club, nomarkrecords.bandcamp.com, the twofingersbeats.bandcamp.com as well for this Fight, Fight, Fight EP. And there's only a few days left if you want to get a vinyl pressing of this. Again, that's twofingersbeats.bandcamp.com. And I'm really curious to see what else you're coming up with, especially this Figueroa and everything else over the coming years. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks for coming on The Vinyl Guide.
Hey, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
There we go. Thank you very much, Amon Tobin, for joining us here on The Vinyl Guide. Again, everyone head over to nomarkrecords.bandcamp.com. There's a video where Amon explains how the new subscription service works. And of course, go to twofingersbeats.bandcamp.com and order a copy of the new Two Fingers EP. Only a few more days left on that. Grab one before the gettin's gone. That's it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. If you enjoy what you've heard, please consider becoming a patron of The Vinyl Guide podcast at patreon.com/vinylguide. A couple of bucks a month keeps your friend Nate nice and happy and gives you exclusive access to extended interviews, secret episodes, early access to these episodes, and more. That's patreon.com/vinylguide. Now, if you enjoy the podcast but are a bit broke at the moment, that's okay too. Please share these episodes on your social media, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. And of course, we always love it when listeners leave positive reviews on iTunes. Give us 5 out of 5 or 10 out of 10 or head over to Stitcher, wherever you get this podcast, leave us a positive review. That is much appreciated as well. Now, we'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate at thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram at Vinyl Guide. Until next time, keep spinning.